So welcome to this episode of Saintly Witnesses, where I talk to the Catholic behind the account. Today I have the privilege of having Nicholas Chansey on, who serves as the director of youth and young adult discipleship for the Diocese of Wheeling-Charleston in West Virginia. So thank you for coming on and sharing a little bit about your faith journey and the work that you do in West Virginia.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, and so I'm really glad to have this, finally had this conversation. I know I reached out some time ago last year, and through countless schedule changes and life events, didn't happen, but I'm glad there was still a willingness and a seed planted for you to contribute. And you eagerly said yeah, so that was good.
The invite was great, you know, because as I'd said earlier, you know, we've been connected for years on Twitter, and just to finally get the opportunity to see each other and hear each other is just a blessing in itself. So
for sure. So I'm sure you have a jam-packed, dynamic faith journey as a Catholic. So how about you summarize some of the major points of your journey? Well, what was it like growing up, middle life, and what led you to now?
Yeah. So, you know, I grew up in Ripley, West Virginia. It's a small town, roughly 4,000 people, and it's very Baptist, a lot of fundamentalists, sprinkling of Methodists here and there. So, you know, my parents were not very Christian people at all. They didn't identify as Christians. And so when it came to things like spirituality, they were much more involved in Native American spiritualities, pagan spiritualities, Celtic folklore. So, you know, on Sunday, instead of going to church, my dad might take me out to the forest, and we'd offer coins to the fairies and milk, and you know, he would tell me that there were spirits in the trees and things. So that was kind of my spirituality growing up. And then my exposure to Christianity was largely from the Baptist pastors who had come to our front porch trying to evangelize us by telling us that we were going to burn in hell since we had not been saved. So as you can imagine, my dad never took too kindly to that. And I think I remember a couple instances where he would be cussing them off the porch or something like that. So as I got older, you know, I kind of just became agnostic because I stopped believing in the folklore, so to speak. And then I got to college. I went to Marshall University in Huntington, West Virginia, and I made a friend who was Catholic, and she invited me to a thing called the Midnight Pancake Breakfast at the Newman Center. And I said, "What's the Newman Center?" And she's like, "Oh, well, it's like the place on campus for Catholics." And I was like, "Oh, it's a Christian thing, you know," and I didn't know if I wanted to go because, you know, are they going to beat me over the head with the Bible, or are they going to tell me I'm not saved? I'd had some burns, so to speak, with Christianity. So I decided to go because I trusted her and she was my friend. And sure enough, I showed up, and all they did was teach me how to make pancakes and get to know me. And it was fun. And so I had a great time. And then they told me, "Yeah, we do dinner for $1 every Thursday. You should come back for dinner." And so I did that. You know, they'd have a home cooked meal, and for $1, you get to eat something that's not cafeteria food and make friends. And so I got to make a lot of friends with those people. And I came back for those dinners every week for years as a college student. And then finally, I just remember one evening sitting in that place and thinking to myself, you know, all of these people are so fun, and they're so kind, and they're so intelligent, and they're all Catholic, right? And without me realizing it, I had sort of become a part of this community. And so I thought to myself, maybe I should look into this. Maybe they're onto something, you know? And by the grace of God, I got connected with a really sweet Polish Catholic family across the river there in Ohio. And they showed me something called the Catholicism series, which at the time was relatively new. And it was from then Father Barron, now Bishop Barron. And they showed me the first episode, and I was just really taken by what he was saying, the way he talked about Jesus. You know, I never really critically thought about Jesus before. And now he's being presented to me as not a figure of hate or vitriol, but as a person who did a lot of mysterious things and who left people in awe, so to speak. And that really intrigued me. And so I watched the whole series, all 10 parts. And then my mom, you know, she could see I was getting into this. So then she watched it with me the second time I watched it. I came back that fall. And I talked to my campus minister and I said, how can I become Catholic? And so the rest is kind of history, so to speak. I was confirmed and baptized into the church on April 19th, 2014. And I graduated the next year and I became a missionary intern for the then diocese youth office. My life had totally changed by that point, and I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And that seemed like a really great place to figure life out. And so they taught me lots of things, everything from how to really get into a good prayer life to putting on events and how to run a zip line and the whole nine yards. It was an amazing year. And then after I finished my time there, a campus ministry position opened up at University of Charleston in West Virginia. And so I went there, and by the grace of God, I got to minister for 3 years and make a lot of friends and build beautiful relationships with those students. And we had some come into the church. I got to make a lot of friends who weren't Catholic, and I got to sort of be the token Catholic down there because there's not a lot of Catholics in Southern West Virginia. And then I got moved back to my old alma mater, and I did campus ministry back there at Marshall University. I did that for 4 years. And then that's where I got married and had a beautiful baby. And she's not a baby anymore. She's two. But we've got another one on the way, which is exciting. I just recently got promoted to director of the whole Office of Youth and Young Adult Discipleship. So we moved again, and now I'm in Wheeling with my family.
Hey, that's really good information, and thank you for sharing. So you've kind of had like a multifaceted faith journey, from like tokenism, folktale religion.
Yeah.
So what's one piece of advice that you would give to somebody who's discerning the Catholic Church?
You know, I think the biggest advice I could give to anybody is don't be afraid to listen. You know, I think we come up with all these assumptions that of things that we think about Catholicism or whatever it is. I mean, it could be anything that we don't know about, really, or we haven't studied. We like to make assumptions about those things. And so when it comes, if anybody that's thinking about becoming Catholic, don't be afraid to listen to what they have to say. You know, there's some good books out there. You know, if you're a reader, I'd recommend Seven Story Mountain by Thomas Merton. That's a really good book. It's by a guy who lived a pretty crazy, debaucherous life and ended up finding Christ in Catholicism. And so that's a pretty beautiful journey. But, you know, I think that'd be the best thing I could recommend is if you're approaching Catholicism, don't be afraid to listen to what they have to say.
That's wise words. Thank you for sharing. So you already kind of laid into it in your faith journey and how you got into ministry. But specifically, I'm wondering, like, what motivated you or, like, what ignited in your soul to say, like, hey, I want to do that?
Yeah. You know, I had originally gone to college to get my degree in economics. And that was entirely because my brother, who is an accountant, he's a CPA, very successful guy. He said, you know, Nick, if you want to make money, you need to get your degree in economics, and then you need to go to law school and get a degree in business law. And me, being age 18 and not having any idea really about anything, I said, great, let's do that. So I went to college and started taking economics courses. And then, I had to have a basic math course to even be allowed to take econ. And I remember withdrawing from that math course because the professor, right? It was the professor. Oh, man, I just can't understand this professor, right? Okay, so it's definitely the professor. So I go back again next year to try to get that basic math course. And sure enough, I'm withdrawing again. And, you know, it's like, okay, what are the odds that I had two bad professors in a row, you know? And so it really came down to, you know, the fact that math was like the basis for what an economics degree is. And I've always hated math, but I never thought about it critically before. So, you know, I got my degree in history, but even then I didn't know what I wanted to do after college. And you know, how do you apply that? You know, do I become a historian, so to speak, and you know, pursue a master's and a doctorate in that? Or do I want to go on to maybe try to teach? So I didn't know for a long time. But then after I had this incredible conversion experience, you know, I'm praying every day. I had never done that before. And I'm thinking about how I can give my life to other people. And that was probably one of the biggest ways that my worldview changed after becoming Catholic, was instead of thinking how the world could serve me and how I could get what I wanted out of life, it was how can I serve the world and what's the way in which God's calling me to do that. And so I knew that I wanted to dedicate my life to the church in some way. I just needed time to figure out what that would look like. And so when I heard that the Diocese Youth Office had a missionary program, I kind of jumped at the opportunity because I knew I'd have a whole year to figure, not only figure out, you know, where is it that God's calling me? What is even my vocation? You know, at the time I didn't know if I was called to be married, if I was called to single life, or whatever. And so, it was a no-brainer for me. And then after that year, you know, then the campus ministry position popped up and I was like, okay, all right, let's do it. I think this is what I'm called to. Cause for me, and everyone's got their own gifts, right? In Catholic world, we'd call that a charism. It's the way that that's the special gifts that God's given you to do his will and to love people. And so for me, you know, my charism, and I've always said this, is friendship. I love building friendships. I love building bonds. I love finding commonality. And so campus ministry and that sort of a charism really just kind of go hand in hand, because you're on the ground and you're meeting students where they're at, and they all come from very different walks of life. And you know, you have this opportunity to be the hands and feet of Christ to these people and to approach them in a non-judgmental, loving way and never shying from your faith, but being that example to them. I've always loved that. And so, you know, getting to do campus ministry for as long as I did really was a treasure. And so, you know, it's always just kind of been about taking the time to really thoughtfully pray and be like, all right, Lord, where is it? Where do you want me? Where are you calling me? Because I'll tell you, when I started at Marshall as a freshman, I definitely would never have thought I'd become Catholic, much less a missionary for the Catholic Church. So, you know, you never know where God's going to call you. But yeah.
Yeah, thank you for sharing. I definitely see the importance of friendship and how that can relate to being a vocation in the church. I think that's at the heart of all relationships, is a degree of like communion and love. So mm-hmm. That's good to hear that you are motivated by that. So my next question is something that I often wondered about. So like West Virginia is like a small, minuscule state. It's like, it's a state mm-hmm. kind of shrouded in obscurity, you know. I don't say that as like a rebuttal or like a chop against West Virginia compared to where I'm in Texas, but it's just like a state like shrouded in secrecy. So as you've grown up in West Virginia and you've like served the needs of people in West Virginia and you work for the church in West Virginia, what are some of the like biggest needs that you see with the population there? Or is it like some of the similar stuff that you would see across nation, like common things that other states have?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question. And I like your perspective, because I think you're right. You know, there is this mystery to West Virginia. Like, what is that place? What's that place between Ohio and Virginia? You know, and is it a state? Is it a part of a state? You know, because there's not an East Virginia, it's just West Virginia. So no, I think you're totally right about that. And that's one of the reasons why I kind of love what I do, is I kind of get to be like this ambassador of West Virginia to the world. So to answer your question, you know, the struggles that West Virginia faces are definitely not unique. You're right. I mean, But they're certainly probably more prevalent as a state than a lot of places. So, for instance, the opioid epidemic, it really has struck this state pretty severely. And so when we're looking at numbers per capita, we have far more people per capita who are either addicted to opioids or are overdosing on them. Just statistically, I mean, it's kind of an absurd number. And so when I was living in Huntington, West Virginia, I mean, that was really sort of considered ground zero for the opioid epidemic. And I mean, Netflix, I think, even made a documentary about it. It's called Heroin. And, you know, it's bad. I remember multiple instances of me driving to the grocery store or wherever, and in the city of Huntington, and you would just see somebody on the ground who had overdosed, because it was just happening all around you that frequently. You know, luckily there were always people who had been called, you know, and I never had to jump into those situations, but it's really bad here. And so, you know, there's a trickle down effect, right? If by being Catholic, we believe that we're all connected to one another, right? No man is an island. We're all part of the body of Christ, and we all sort of have a responsibility to help each other and serve each other. And the actions, our actions, good or bad, will affect other people. And so, you know, we're seeing that in spades now in West Virginia when it comes to the opioid epidemic, because, you know, you have these people who are addicted to these substances and their whole lives revolve around them. Well, those people have kids, right? Those people are having children. And so there are communities in the state of West Virginia where 80 up to 80% of the children in those communities are living with their grandparents. They don't live with their parents. And so, you know, that's really bad. You see that happen in other parts of the country on a micro scale, right? It might be in certain parts of a city, or it might be in certain parts of a state. But for West Virginia, it really is like a very large portion of the state that's going through this. So, you know, even though my own dealings in ministry are mostly college students and young people, right, I can't ignore the glaring red flag that our state faces, which is this opioid epidemic. Because even though I don't necessarily deal with people who are addicted on a personal basis, I do deal with the people who have had to live with the fallout of that, right? With people who have grown up with only one mom or dad, people who have grown up only with their grandparents because both of their parents were addicted to substances, or their parents had died or what have you. So, you know, I really do think that's probably the biggest issue. And then of course, the other big one is poverty. West Virginia is consistently the poorest or one of the poorest states in America. And so, you know, it's this really, really horrible combination of this horrible drug epidemic, and then incredibly high level of poverty. And so it really takes a lot for us living here to understand that those people are still people. You know, there's a real temptation to want to devalue them, to want to see them as other. But the fact of the matter is, regardless, they are human beings that command respect, right? They command dignity. They don't lose that just because of the life choices they've made. And quite frankly, we don't know the circumstances in which they fell into those things either. And, you know, I try to tell people that, you know, I could have back surgery tomorrow and be prescribed OxyContin and then find myself addicted to that substance afterward, and I could be on the street just like that person. I mean, it can happen to anybody. So I try to preach that to as many people as I can, that, you know, we can't be dehumanizing, but we need to be supportive and caring for our brothers and sisters out there. So, you know, when I look at the challenges our state faces, that epidemic, the broken homes that come from it, the sheer number of children that we have in the foster care system here, those I think are probably some of the biggest challenges.
Yeah, and like I said, you know, some of these challenges, these are not just unique to West Virginia. Like some of the stuff regarding drug abuse and poverty or across the other state lines, but I can definitely understand how it could be like a state of emergency or like super like in your face and blatant in West Virginia, given its like population and size. So thank you for sharing, and thank you for, you know, dignifying those who in society may be discarded. I think that's very important that despite the life choices and decisions that people made, that we still don't count anybody off as like irredeemable. So it's good to know that you're hands-on in that way. So my last question has to do with like your work with the Diocese of Wheeling-Charleston. What does the work that you do now as a director involve? And like, what's some long-term or short-term things that you hope to achieve in this capacity?
Yeah, you know, so I think the really beautiful thing that I get to do now is, in you know, instead of being stuck to a college campus, right, and the students being those people who I'm feeding into and who I'm you know, helping to disciple, I sort of get to do that now across the state with our leaders who are on the ground in those places. So for me, that means traveling and meeting with our campus ministers, meeting with our youth ministers, even meeting with some of our pastors, and really on a case-by-case basis, helping them and helping to give them the tools they need to be able to either disciple the young people in front of them or to begin the process of doing that. And so, you know, it's really, really fun. So, you know, talk about relationships, right? I'm still very much bringing those relationships into that role. And, you know, I think a lot of it is, you know, we want our young people to be discipled. We want our young people to stay in the church or to come into the church. And so, well, we can't do that if we don't have a relationship with them. And, you know, so when I'm looking long-term, right, how do I want to change the culture in our state, what I want to do is I want to help change the way in which our faithful in the pews look at young people, right, and treat young people. And I feel like so often these folks are looked at as other. You know, we don't know what to do with them. We don't know what they're into. We don't know what their interests are. I don't have TikTok, so how can I be relevant to them or whatever? And it's like, well, you know, it's not really TikTok they're looking for. It's just somebody who cares, somebody who's not afraid to spend time with them. So, you know, helping the faithful in the pews to see that they don't necessarily need to hire a youth minister. They just need to come together as a community to support these young people, right? Whether that's going to sporting events, whether that's hosting events at their parish, whether that is, you know, coordinating and going on trips with them, but creating those opportunities where they can, on a personal level, get to know these young people and walk with them in their own spiritual journey. I think that's hugely important. And I think long-term, that's how we actually not only keep our young people, but actually grow the church is through building those relationships. And then by doing that, discipling them. So that's sort of the broad view of how I see our office moving forward.
And that's important too, you know, empowering the youth and young adults through community and fellowship and love so that they can rely on each other. But most importantly, turn to the church for that foundation, spiritual foundation that's unshakable for the future. So that's good to know that you have like a strategic short-term and long-term plan for the youth and young adult ministry. So my last question I like to ask is like a really fun question. So who is your favorite saint and why? You know, in the church, we talk about the communion of saints, and we have the saints that we look up to for intercession. So who are some of your favorite saints and why do you love them so much?
You know, that's a really good question. And there's definitely a lot that I deeply admire. If I had to pick one, I think I would go with St. John Paul II. And it is kind of personal. I was, you know, as I said, growing up, I was not a religious person. But he died in the spring of 2005, and I was in seventh grade. And I'll never forget, I was on spring break, and I had the flu. So I have all this time off from school, but I can't go anywhere. I can't do anything. I'm stuck at home. I've got like a gallon of orange juice and like a box of Kleenex. And so it's a rare thing where my family let me have control of the TV because they felt so bad for me. And because I love history, I knew that his death was a really big deal historically. Even though I wasn't invested in it in a religious way, I still wanted to be a part of it and watch it. And so that whole week I was glued to the TV watching this 24-hour news coverage. And in that time, I saw things I'd never seen before. I saw processions. I saw men with pointy hats, men with red hats, men with purple hats. I saw lots of incense. I saw statues. I saw all of these things that, again, as somebody that grew up in poor rural West Virginia, were totally foreign to me. And I found it fascinating. And then I heard the songs, you know, I heard the Litany of Saints, and I saw these people speak and pray, and I was sort of consumed by it. And so even though that event didn't directly lead to me becoming Catholic then, it absolutely played a big role in my openness to becoming Catholic later. And I can't help but think in those early days, you know, St. John Paul II wasn't a part of that, you know, praying for me. And so I have a personal closeness to him. And you know, he had such a heart for young people. He spent so much of his time with young people. And again, building relationships. He would literally take these young adults out into the woods and they would go hiking and they would go camping. They'd go canoeing. And the whole time he's just there with them, he's getting to know them. He's laughing at their jokes. And he's sharing his faith with them. And so when I look at my work in youth and young adult discipleship, he is very much the guide that I use to this day.
Yeah, powerful figure of the 20th century. I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think JP2 was the pope that visited Africa the most, or he's one of the
I think
in
so.
recent history he visited the continent the most, or
Yeah.
one of the top, next probably next to Pope Francis.
Right.
But yeah, he played a significant role in like ensuring the church was nurtured, like during his pontificate in Africa, and I always think that's very important to nurture the church, especially across the world in the global south,
Amen.
where Christianity is just booming there.
Absolutely.
Well, I definitely appreciate you coming on and finally making this conversation so fruitful and abundant with so much wisdom and knowledge regarding your faith journey and highlighting some of the most important work that you do for the Diocese of Wheeling, Charleston, and giving a little bit of information about the nature of West Virginia. Like I said, some people may not know West Virginia
Right.
compared to other states, but it's good that we are like aware of at least some of the core issues that impact so many Americans across the country.
Amen.
Well, you guys should definitely pray for Nicholas and his work that he does and his family, and pray for the well-being pray for the well-being of him and his wife as they await the newborn in months to come. How many months is that?
We're looking at April, so we've got about 6 more months.
Okay, y'all got a long way to go still. Two
Yep.
kids. Two kids is gonna be an interesting dynamic. You coming from somebody who got two kids?
Yes, sir. That's what they tell me.
It's real wild, but it's a good journey. I wouldn't trade it for nothing else.
Amen.
Well, you guys keep Nicholas in your prayers, and you can tune in to the next episode of Saintly Witnesses.